Okay, and this surface, so we're not yet, haven't yet done the job of actually writing a nice metric for ADS just in, you know, D plus one coordinates. But the advantage of this is similar as the advantage of looking at the metric of two sphere by embedding it in R3. You see all the symmetries explicitly. So this has SO D,2 symmetry. And because this is not abelian, you can't write a metric that's sort of just in the D plus one dimensions that would manifest all these symmetries. But you can take your pick depending on what it is that you want the actual, you know, line element in specific coordinates to emphasize. So suppose you want to describe a spherical object in ADS, let's say star sitting in middle of ADS, and, you know, nothing happening in time, then the most useful thing is to sort of combine these coordinates and these coordinates to sort of manifest the staticity and the spherical symmetry. So we did this, you guys probably did this for the problem set. That will be, so I won't rewrite what the embedding for this was, but the metric that you get at the end of the day is R squared plus 1 dt squared plus dr squared over R squared plus 1 plus R squared d omega d minus 1 squared. Okay, so this is just the metric of the d minus 1 sphere that generalizes the two sphere we have been talking about for four-dimensional space-time. And you can see that this is manifestly static. Nothing depends on t. There is no cross terms in t. And spherically symmetric. We're again choosing r to be the to measure the proper area of the spheres. So this is very reminiscent of the Schwarzschild metric we had been writing down, except that now it's clearly not asymptotically flat. It's asymptotically ADS. And it manifests on a subpart of the symmetry. Yeah.
So what is this x minus 1?
Oh, this is just a label for, so I want two time and d spatial dimensions in my larger flat space to embed this surface into. Okay, so I just labeled it. You can label it whatever you want. I just kept going with the subscripts in the opposite direction, but...
Why do you use another time but not another space to embed this?
Yeah, so if you do that, you end up... So you could have done, for example, another space if you were embedding a Lorentzian version of a sphere. That would give you something that's called the de-sitter space-time. Okay, that's a different space-time. That's a positive cosmological constant one. So there are many things you can do. It's a nifty way of generating these maximally symmetric space-times. But for the negatively curved thing, so the symmetry of the space-time that I want is this. So I knowing that, I in hindsight, I know that I will need two times.
So my understanding is that, I mean, this kind of curvature, it should be able to embed in any higher dimensional space, you know, correct?
So that's complicated. So if you have a Riemannian space, which has just positive definite metric, you're guaranteed to be able to embed it in d-dimensional one. You're guaranteed to be able to embed it in 2D dimensional Riemannian flat Euclidean space. For Lorentzian d-dimensional spacetimes, there's not a straightforward nice theorem like that. Do you know, Don, what is the status? Okay, so there is, in many cases, you can embed it in sort of higher dimensional, much more than 2D dimensional Lorentzian space-time, or maybe even, that's more complicated. And I think something is known, and I also believe that there is not a complete statement, but I may be wrong on that.
So in short, BDS just cannot be embedded in just the D plus one dimension space. It has to use a time, right?
It will have to use a time, yeah. Yeah. So certainly, but it's clear that isometrically embedding Lorentzian space-time in Riemannian won't be possible because you'll never mock up the negative directions. You'll never get a negative distance, negative value of the line element. Right, so you need at least one time. In this case, it's very efficient to do it with one extra time, but certainly a priori that's not guaranteed. So once we would go to black hole in ADS, it's certainly not the case that it's embeddable nicely in some, you know, flat D plus, you know, D plus one dimensional, sorry, D plus two dimensional flat space time with any number of times. Okay, so this is one nice form of the metric that you can generate, and in fact you can check that the coordinate ranges here, you know, R is between zero and infinity, and time is between minus infinity and infinity, and the angles do the usual thing, does cover the entire space-time in the sense that any geodesic in the space-time, which at any finite affine parameter remains within this coordinate range. So it doesn't have any coordinate singularities, and it covers the whole thing. So this is what people call the global ADS.
I suppose there's a slightly subtle point. If you do the embedding, you get this period.
Oh, yes, very good, yes. So indeed, so if you look at this, so this is like a hyperboloid in, let's say, in the x naught, x minus 1, x minus 1, and then here are the xi's. So you get a hyperboloid like this. Okay, this is a weird picture. Shade this or something. Then the time, so which I would have obtained by taking x minus 1 is something like square root of r squared plus 1 sine t, and x naught something like square root of r squared plus 1 cos t or something like that. These are periodic in t, and so what you want to do to get the time direction being non-compact and not having any trivial closed time-like curves is to just declare that the range of t is not from 0 to 2 pi or periodically identified, but just decompactified going from, as I have written, minus infinity to infinity. So for a single direction like this, you can always do it. Locally, I'm not telling you the global, whether time was compactified or not in this line element. I'm specifying that separately. And so here, I just declare that specification.
What happened to L? There was a line.
Oh, sorry, and I did this last time. Okay, so that comes, okay, so here there should have been, I think there would have been a t over L here probably, and there would have been an L squared like this, okay, and then there is an r squared over L squared. Okay, I'm not sure about this, you have to check, but this I'm sure about, r squared over L squared. Okay, so it just, the L introduces, well, tells you the length scale, that's the only scale in the problem, the only scale that the space-time knows about. And again, it's sort of an analog, so here this is the sort of size L here, is the analog of a radius of a sphere, except that instead of a sphere, we're taking a negatively curved space-time, and so the L is the length scale associated with that. So often, the thing that people do is sort of declare that L is 1, which amounts to choosing units such that all the other quantities that have dimensions of length that you're talking about them numerically in ADS units rather than in some other units. Okay, so here you might be thinking, okay, L is something, some number, and then this is implicitly in some, you know, other unspecified units. So if we set L to 1, you're specifying the unit. Good. Okay, so that, if you decompactify this, okay, and I have, and add in at least one of these sphere dimensions, so instead of having a, you know, a two surface like this, I'll have a three-dimensional picture, you get this, this sort of a soup can. That's my favorite representation of ADS. You have the T direction going up, you have the sort of R direction, but such that in this picture, R is infinity is the boundary here, and you had the sort of the sphere directions. Just so this is one of the sphere directions here. Okay, so are there any questions about that? That's one of the things that I did say very quickly in the lecture. Yeah? Okay.
Should I imagine the soup can to be hyperbolic, or is it?
No, this way it's explicitly static. There is no dependence on time.
Right.
So the size of it is the same. And actually, what am I actually plotting here if I'm to plot sort of, if you think of sort of plotting, physically plotting some geodesic, say, on it or something, then you can do it by the coordinates where you let R sort of compactify R to call it 10, some other coordinate rho. So literally here, this one is my rho, which reaches a value pi half. And so this is rho being pi quarter, which corresponds to exactly, oh, sorry, and then I'm taking the unit out. So that was R equal to the ADS radius when you're sort of halfway in the soup can if you use these coordinates. And so if you shift, if you compactify R like this, the line element, which is a simple exercise to check, is 1 over cos squared rho minus dt squared plus d rho squared plus sine squared rho d omega squared. Okay, and then instead of dealing with RT and omega, you can deal with rho T and omega, and then that picture really is the unit of rho is same distance as on the blackboard. All right. So I think in one of the exercises that you had was to sort of look at what the various geodesics look like in this space-time. Yeah.
There are sort of two hyperbolic directions here and one here, right?
Well, there's, what do you mean two hyperbolic?
Like two.
Oh, this is a surface. So this direction was what we promoted to T and decompactified. So that's this direction. And this direction is what was this R that goes to infinity. And this, so it was just a two surface. But now I, instead of keeping just the RT plane, where the infinity would have been the infinity, you know, at infinite x high like this, I have also reinstated one of these directions. So each point here is a d minus one sphere. Sorry. Okay. Okay. Each circle here is a d minus one sphere of radius, well, or rather of proper area given by this radial coordinate r. So the size of these spheres goes to infinity as you go to r equal to infinity, to the boundary. And okay, with respect to this coordinate, it's the metric is manifest, this very quasi-metric.
Veronica, you have this compactified T or whatever you did, and for those who are not familiar with this, do we need to think about it in any way, or is it just that the initial surface is no longer the object we're interested in?
Well,
it
is if you think of sort of say moving on this surface and not having any memory that, you know, you already were there. Locally, it just looks, the two are identical.
Locally, it's not. Right.
So it's just that, and if you think of moving on the surface, it's not, it doesn't make any difference. It's only if you.
Well, time is cyclic.
Yeah, so if you insist that whatever particles or fields had to, you know, somehow come back to themselves, even if they're not following geodesics, then there would be a difference.
But even causality, I mean, if you try to...
Yeah, so
that could be very complicated there, right? There is a time loop.
That's right. So that's why we decompactify, but there is no... But once you declare that time is not to be periodically identified, you know, with t plus 2 pi, again, some within the length scale, then... but rather range to infinite range, then there is no longer any subtlety. This is like a trick, a tool to be able to see all the symmetries explicitly and then use this to construct the most convenient line element that you want to be dealing with. This is just one possibility.
So the symmetries were very clear when you introduced the initial surface.
Right, and here they're obscure. Here it's manifestly static and spherically symmetric, but the other symmetries are hidden.
But my question is, once the symmetries were the symmetries of the original surface.
Which are independent of, you know, whether you declared T later on to be decompactified or not.
Is that obvious? I mean, I just have to believe that.
Yeah, for now, just believe.
Okay.
Okay, I would have to think of a good set of statements.
So, from this kind of picture, it seems that T is cyclic, but R is not. But like in this ABS, it seems that R should be like periodic kind of thing.
Why?
I heard someone saying that in ABS, if you throw a ball or something, like it will come back.
It will come back, but why does it come back? Okay, so here actually that makes the periodicity a bit more natural. The geodesics in ADS you could generate by sort of slicing this hyperboloid by a plane and seeing where the intersection lies. But you can also forget about that entirely. Just work with the line element and solve for what the geodesics look like. And once you do that exercise, solve for what the geodesics look like within just the, you know, D plus one dimensional line element, you'll find that the time-like ones, indeed, well, one trivial time-like one, again, by symmetry has to be just stuck here at the origin because it doesn't have any, it doesn't know where to deviate, and so it has to stay there. But another one, if you have some initial velocity like this, it turns out that it oscillates back and forth. There's some maximum radius it reaches, and it comes back after a period, let's say this was t equal to zero, period pi times the ADS scale. T is minus pi times L here. So the period is 2 pi L. And if you have larger velocity like this, it actually comes back at the same, sorry, this is a terrible picture, but it's supposed to come back, you know, halfway around the period. And if you have a null geodesic, sort of the limit of infinite boost here, it also does the same thing. Oh. Really terrible picture. Okay, it's supposed to come back by the sort of set of null lines like this.
So
why is that? It's exactly the same. So if you write the effective potential, you know, for the geodesic motion, you find that the effective potential of pure ADS is just a parabola coming from the R squared. And in fact, you know this from sort of classical mechanics. It's the harmonic oscillator. If you have a spring or a pendulum, the period of oscillation is independent with, you know, where you start this thing. It's independent of the amplitude. The period is always the same, and that's exactly what you're seeing here for the geodesics.
So does it mean that space is still infinite? It's just about, I mean, the
so you're moving. Yeah, there is no periodic identification in R at all. It just gets larger and larger as you go to the boundary. You're going further and further up this potential. But because you're going further up this potential, at some point you're going to fall back down. So you're going to return through the origin. For radial geodesics, you're going to return through the origin and slosh around like this. So think of this as a pendulum or a spring that's sort of pulled more towards the center the further out it is.
So what is the boundary of the space?
The boundary of the space is all the way up at the r equal to infinity. But it has a distinct structure from asymptotically flat space-time, where something that I didn't show you explicitly, but is true, the boundary itself has a null structure. Here, that's not the case. So for example, you can have these null geodesics that sort of slosh around and return to the boundary in multiple places. That would not be the case in flat space or flat space time. So here, the boundary metric, the induced metric on a large sphere like this of some large radius, as you take the limit of the radius going to infinity to figure out what's the induced metric on the boundary, is basically constant r just sets dr to be zero, and you're left with these two terms, and you see that the t scales the same way at large r as the sphere. So if you then rescale everything by r squared, you're just getting minus dt squared plus d omega squared as the metric for the boundary. And that's a time-like surface. It's something called the Einstein static universe. It just has a form of a cylinder, a sphere across time. And it's manifestly time-like, which is very important in the ADS-CFT context, because there the theory that we're putting to be dual to this, to physics happening in the space-time, to string theory in ADS, is living, you can think of it as living on the boundary, and very conveniently by living in a Lorentzian space-time means that that dual field theory can have its own evolution. It has its own time, and it, you know, behaves in a sensible way.
So, sorry, I mean,
which is much harder for asymptotically flat space where you don't have a nice time.
So I still don't quite get what is the boundary, the size of the phenomenon, the size of the space, like what decided that?
What is what?
I mean, what decided? I mean, what?
Who decided where the boundary is?
Yes.
Ah, so take any geodesic. Let's take. The time-like ones don't make it to the boundary, but say take a space-like geodesic and look at the affine parameter. Okay, it's ticking off proper length, but it's going to be shrinking such that you hit this place at infinite affine parameter. So the boundary is sort of the collection of all endpoints of all geodesics when they reach the infinite plus or minus infinite affine parameter. Okay, so you have to go, this is sort of compactified picture. If you were measuring length, they would get, you know, here the ticks of equal proper length get shorter and shorter and shorter until they get to zero on the boundary. Set equivalently, a given proper length, you know, along the boundary, well, you know, maybe if I take a segment, a strip like this in this diagram, here it's really short, but here it's going to be infinite. The same, you know, what looks like the same coordinate distance is going to be infinite proper distance as you get close to the boundary. Same about time. Here, this little increment here, this was short time, but the same increment on this diagram has infinite proper time. And that's, by the way, another way of, So the way that you can read off what's the, say, proper time, you know, between along this curve or this curve or this curve or this curve is to do the calculation we did for the proper time. In this case, it's really simple because you're at constant r, so you can forget about this, and you're at constant angle, so you can forget about this, and you're just calculating, you know, the ds squared, square root of that for this. So it's really the constant, the proper time goes as, you know, the whatever the value of r you're at over l times this coordinate distance. And because the value of r goes to infinity here, that proper time goes to infinity. Okay, other questions? So the geodesics, the time-like radial geodesics look like this. You also probably found that if you add angular momentum, you also have the geodesic periodic with the same period, but now instead of going, you know, think of the pendulum again, instead of swinging in a single plane, it's like it's swinging around in a circle or ellipse or something like that. So exactly the same thing happens here. You can have sort of circular orbits that are again, all right, this is getting far too cluttered, but the top view of them, if I look from top, so this is just a row and some angle, let's call it phi, the time-like geodesics would be either sort of sloshing around back and forth like this, or they could be circular orbits at any given radius, or they could be anything in between. They would be ellipses of any given size. So those are the time-like projection of the time-like geodesics onto what's called a, this is the so-called Poincaré disk. It's just a horizontal slice of that soup can and your or top view of that soup can. You can also find that null geodesics do something interesting. The null geodesics, if you look at the effective potential, it actually goes to a constant, and so a negative constant. So the null geodesics all make it out to the boundary. There are no null circular orbits for pure radius. So they all start somewhere at the boundary, and the radial one just goes straight across. That's this one that I have just drawn here. But if you give it some angular momentum, what happens is that the projection of it comes and then returns to the same point. And in fact, they all return to the same point. That's antipodally separated in the angle, but a time that's not seen on this projection, time that's pi times the ADS length later. So if I draw them on the soup can, they would look, so this is the radial one, but then they would be looking like this. And so unlike, you know, a cylinder in flat space, where going around the rim takes much longer than going straight through, in ADS, all these geodesics, all these non-geodesics get through ADS with the same time, same boundary time. Okay, so that's something special about ADS. It's not true if you sort of deform the ADS geometry than the ones that, for example, if you put in some gravitational potential well, some star like this, there's a gravitational time delay from the potential well, so the radial ones that go through the junk inside would get out later. If you put in a black hole, the ones that fall into the black hole, of course, never get out. But the boundary ones, you know, don't really feel what's inside, so they always get around ADS, you know, halfway around the sphere at precisely the ADS, half of the pi times the ADS time later. Right? So that's the null geodesics. Now, space-like geodesics, you can actually draw at constant t. You don't even have to project. They look like, this was time null ones. Space-like ones, let's say we start here. Oops. Look like this. Again, there will be a symmetric one that goes straight across, but the other ones are these sort of arcs that look like this. In fact, so if you look at this projection, the null ones are always perpendicular to the space-like ones. But okay, that's a cute aside. Okay, so that's what the space-like ones look like. Yeah.
They return to that point half of the pi times L later, but what if you start?
So pi times L later.
So this was pi times
this
L.
This is now again a misleading picture. I should have drawn it properly in the first place. So this was supposed to now be my t equal to zero. It's just
Okay, that explains.
Yeah.
the space like geodesics are all like perpendicular with the boundary of the disk?
Yes, yes. And the reason that that had to happen is they want to, well, so at constant time, you have just a Riemannian metric. You want the space like geodesics to minimize a distance. And the distance gets infinite here. So they want to get away from the region of large distance as fast as they can. If they were sort of hitting it at an angle, then this is much more cost in this infinite distance. Yeah.
So these space-like geodesics that you draw, you can imagine them at t equals zero. So
yes, indeed. You can also calculate space-like geodesics that are in some tilted surface. Then the so for this, the constant of motion that corresponds to time translation, the energy would be zero. For the tilted ones, the energy would be something non-zero. And it basically, well, it's not very different from just tilting this. The curves shift around a little bit. And there's, for pure ADS, you can write an exact expression for what the curve actually looks like and so forth. But okay, yeah.
So I'm just wondering, what is an observer then? An observer in ADS, he sends a right ray to the light ray to the boundary.
Uh-huh.
He just sees it bounce off.
Yeah. So you would, they can be sitting at the origin, mm-hmm. and then the light ray comes back. Or their friend who's following, who's another inertial observer moving with a, some different velocity, also comes back.
Very old.
No, because the it's actually there's a symmetry between all of these. There isn't a preferred origin really. It's just a quark of the coordinates. And what's happening is that even though this what looked like, you know, instead of going like this, you went like that. Even though this looks almost null, and so you might think it takes less proper time, you're paying the price of being near to the boundary, and it balances out. It's actually just a symmetry between this guy and this guy. So they take exactly the same proper time to get to this point.
Maybe the fact that the proper time is getting very quick as I go to
it's very getting very quick, but it's looking more and more null. So if it were flat space and it was going more and more null, then it would be shorter proper time. If it's ADS and you're going vertically, it would be longer proper time. And the two effects exactly cancel this way in ADS. And in fact, you know, here we picked r equal to 0 is some origin, but here there is no origin. It's translationally invariant. So you know you had better not have had any origin, anything to tag you in to ADS. So the fact that you had some geodesic that looks sort of to be the preferred one, the static one at the origin, and all these guys looked sort of different, that's a mirage. That's just artifact of the coordinates. This one, you can boost, act by a symmetry of the space-time to declare this is the origin and this one was the oppositely boosted one. And so it had better be, since these two are related by symmetry, it had better be that the proper time, which is a geometric quantity, should be invariant under that symmetry. Yeah.
So this means that every point in space is not equivalent.
Every point in space is equivalent.
But like if you, I mean,
except for the boundary, which is not part of the space-time.
The boundary is not, but like somewhere close to the boundary is like not equivalent. Somewhere is.
That's right. So ADS CFT actually it captures that very nicely because the CFT, the theory that lives on the boundary, is a conformal field theory. It's scale invariant, and so the transformation to get what looks like it's closer to the boundary is the same as a scale transformation on the boundary within the CFT, which doesn't do anything. So in fact, there is a, in ADS CFT, you'll hear in the ADS CFT lectures probably tomorrow, that there is a what people call UVIR correspondence or scale radius duality, which sort of associates sort of the distance from the boundary with a scale within the boundary that's precisely sort of commensurate with the distance from the boundary in this type of picture.
So all points in ADS are equivalent.
Yes.
But you're also saying that all...
Which you see from here.
But
But you're also saying that all space-like geodesics are equivalent, can be mapped one
yes.
to another?
Yes, yes.
By...
So the boosts are also part of the symmetry.
All of them?
All of them.
And is that is it true also for like
yes.
null
yes. geodesics? Yes, yes, yes. So it's maximally symmetric space-time.
That, is that,
ADS is a maximally.
Is that an implication of being maximal?
Yes, it's an implication of maximum because otherwise it would have broken some symmetry by being able to distinguish from one geodesic to the other. The other way, the implication is harder to see, but okay.
Sorry, I think my confusion is that, for example, if someone is sitting close to one of the boundaries, then we send some light into one direction and the other direction. So the light, the time that these two beam of light will come back is different, is not correct?
That's right, but at the same time, sitting, you see, sitting here, that is not a geodesic. If you start here with zero velocity, you would be on one of these guys that follow a geodesic, you would slosh around. To sit here means you have to accelerate very hard to keep yourself up on the hillside without rolling down, up on this sort of gravitational potential well. So, indeed, there will be an asymmetry. You send light this way and it comes back after a short time. You send it here and it comes back out after a long time. But that's to be expected because you're sort of accelerating, you're breaking the symmetry yourself by sort of keeping on this trajectory. On the other hand, if you don't accelerate and you're following this trajectory, then it doesn't matter. Then the light from here catches up with you in the same, well, if I drew it properly, let's see, it catches up with you at exactly the same moment.
But if these people, I mean, if this person wants to go to like this direction or this direction, and he will go back to the same, I mean,
yeah, they all, everything is periodic in the same time, so they all come back to the same point in all directions.
Okay.
Okay.
So,
yeah.
Like a perfect harmonic oscillator can have with the metric log, have
exactly.
arbitrarily big amplitude without exceeding the speed of light.
Exactly, exactly, yes, indeed. So the proper distance, so you can indeed go large, what would have been a large proper distance along a spatial direction. You can do that in finite time. You see, your speed, local speed, is not simply dividing a proper distance, you know, by some difference in time. Of course, the turnaround would also take a long proper time here. But, you know, if you were going in, you know, statically like that, but the invariant notion is just the proper time along that curve, and that always, you know, that's the same for independent of the boost. Okay, so that's one picture that people use for ADS. If you encounter ADS CFT in, say, condensed matter scenario, where people, you know, think of the CFTs as mocking up systems that we might construct in a lab, you know, piece of a metal or what have you, they don't want to think of pieces of metal on a sphere. They want to think of flat pieces of metal. And indeed, you can use different embedding to manifest a flat symmetry that the boundary really is Minkowski flat metric rather than this Einstein static universe. So the way you do it, you sort of pair up these guys slightly differently. You sort of choose one of these and then the rest of them. And the upshot of that pairing is what's called Poincaré ADS. It's only a subset of the global ADS. And the metric, so I wrote this last time as well, for ADS in the D plus one dimensions, is reinstating the ADS size L squared over some radial coordinate, which people like to call Z, so over Z squared. Here you have a Minkowski metric in D dimensions. So let me write it I equals 1 to D to be, sorry, D minus 1 to be explicit. DXI squared, hopefully that's less confusing than what I did last time. And then plus the Z coordinate, like so. Okay, so this is the metric of the same space-time, ADS, in D plus one dimensions. But now you can see that it has, at every given Z, which we also call radial coordinate, the it's foliated by just flat spacetime in d dimensions. However, it's foliated by flat d-dimensional spacetime with a conformal factor, with a scale factor that grows as z gets to zero. So the boundary is at z equal to zero. And now people often draw the picture. I mean, okay, this is now depends on which pictures you have seen, but let's say this is the z direction, z is equal to zero here, and it's the boundary. And the bulk, the ADS direction is here, and then the x mu's, the d-dimensional space-time are what people call these boundary coordinates. Okay, this is just mostly a linguistic or notational aside, but I guess many of the lecturers will be using this terminology without, you know, stopping to say what they mean. Now, in terms of where this is in global ADS, okay, so the easiest way to find the coordinate transformation, these coordinates have nothing to do with these coordinates, so I should probably call this, let's say, tilde. It's different from that time. Let me just call all of them tildes to be consistent. The tilded coordinates are distinct from these. And to go between them, the easiest way is to recourse back to the embedding and then solve the equations that x minus 1 written in terms of RT and the spheres is the same as x minus 1 written in terms of the tilded coordinates and the same for all the other capital X's. Okay, so you have set of equations to solve, nonlinear equations to solve, to figure out the coordinates. So it's a bit messy. Not too messy, but a bit messy. And the picture, again, in terms of where this is on the global ADS, is, so the z equal to zero is a boundary, but it's flat. So we want somehow to get flat sections from here. And the trick to do that, well, if I look at my Poincaré disk right here, if I look at that picture, so again, a top view, and I want to have I pick some point, let's say I pick a point here, I'll call this suggestively I naught, I can consider sort of surfaces that would correspond to just flat lines, say, x-axis, that end up being sort of the same distance from each other as you go all around this. So as you get close to the boundary, the proper distance, of course, gets infinite, so these curves all degenerate to the same point. It's like, you know, keeping proper distance the same in this diagram. And so this span sort of the picture like this. So if I associate this point with this, so the constant x tilde i's sort of look like these circles. Now I'm going to try to draw it on a t equal to constant slice. So on the other hand, the time direction, that's sort of a similar type of thing. And the upshot is that the set of null geodesics from this point corresponds to sort of the plane z equal to infinity, and set of fast-going null geodesics from that point correspond to z equal to minus infinity. And so this is the boundary of the coordinate patch used for the Poincaré coordinates. This is the so-called Poincaré wedge. If you look at the coordinates just within here, that's precisely sort of giving you this Poincaré spacetime. So the constant z coordinates, if I just slice this flat through and forget about the sphere directions, the constant z, this would be z equal to L. This would be getting to z equal to zero, so this would be like half L. And this would be getting to z equal to infinity by the time you get up here. So these are the orbits, constant z are simultaneously the orbits of this d by d t tilde, the time translations, just as for black hole, we had these time translations that look curved on the Penrose diagram, whereas the let me draw it in purple, whereas the standard t was always going up in the Supkin picture. Yeah?
I'm confused by what the first thing you said. You have the Poincaré disk.
Yes.
Yeah. Time slice.
Yeah.
But it involves going into the scale. So,
yes.
But in the drawing that you have.
So this was the boundary.
Yes.
In these coordinates, that would have corresponded all to rho being pi half or r being infinite.
Yes.
This was the origin of r.
That's right.
Okay.
And when you do that in the.
And these circles are supposed to be like x tilde equal to l, let's say. Well, the one that goes through the origin is the x tilde being the l.
Yes, but I would have expected. So you drew also an analogy with these lines on the other coordinates.
Oh, the t tilde, or what?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
For the tilde coordinates.
Yes.
You said this plane is z equal to 0. And then.
So that plane.
Yes.
That plane is the boundary. If you consider only the surface of the cylinder, and you unwrap it, so that you identify this with this, okay, so this wrapped would be, say, this line. So let's say this point is the I naught and I naught, then the size, you know, to go around is the same as the way to go up. And in fact, it turns out that this, so let me label this suggestively as chi plus, which comes here and here. And similarly, if I label these boundary null geodesics by chi minus, they come here and here. This point, I minus, corresponds to this point. So on the ADS boundary, the Poincaré ADS boundary is just within this diamond, which is exactly the Penrose diagram for just flat space time.
I was confused by Argo. You said, let's consider the Poincaré disk. And then you start a drawing within it.
Uh-huh.
And the equivalent lines on the other
uh-huh, on this one, yes.
Seem to have to be all be at z equal to 0.
Oh, sorry. Yes, I can take it any finite z. So this is supposed to be comparing. I don't have time direction. I'm comparing, let's say, this with this with another plane further down.
Okay, now you're going into the bulk.
And I'm going into the bulk. So this is going into the bulk. Yeah, sorry. That was Max.
I think you said, in one picture it looks like the boundary is flat. In the other picture it looks like it's curved. So.
That's right, but we're keeping different part of the boundary. We're keeping here only a subset of the boundary.
Is that equal zero boundary there?
It only reaches up to here.
No, but
the coordinates become infinite here. So in Poincaré ADS, that gives you this picture. This is all you have.
Where is z equal to zero on that cylinder?
The whole plane is z equal to zero.
No, on the cylinder?
On this?
Yeah.
Oh, it's on the surface of the cylinder.
But isn't the surface?
So on this, on the Poincaré disk picture.
That's on the surface. That
it would be. So this guy, the boundary, is indeed z equal to zero, except that this point is not very close to this point. This is, you know, completely opposite direction in the x directions, in the x tilde directions. So this is like x tilde being infinity, and this is like x tilde being minus infinity, and this was like x tilde being 0. So that circle is this circle. And this was the x tilde being 0 right here, and plus and minus infinite here. But the z at the boundary is 0 all the way around.
In the tilted coordinates, it looks like the boundary is flat. And is that true?
Yes. So.
But in the boundary of the Poincaré cylinder is not. The boundary of the cylinder is not flat, right? Especially if you go to like.
But you're just looking at the sort of the boundary metric, and the reason. Well, okay, sorry. There's an important issue here that I sort of suppressed. The boundary metric is really specified up to a conformal rescaling. And so it's not that you have a flat metric being equivalent to a curved metric, but it's the Einstein static universe is conformally flat.
When you say conformal rescaling, this is basically strict. What is it exactly?
So it's if you have a metric, so yeah, I didn't get to lecture that. So if you have a metric, let's say G mu nu, you can specify it in terms of some other metric multiplied by some conformal factor, okay, some quantity, where these are all, of course, functions of x. And this can be function of x. So it's locally corresponds to rescaling all your distances. At any given point, sort of isotropically, but you can the amount of rescaling can vary from point to point.
By a scalar per point.
By a scalar per point. Okay, so this is a function of all the coordinates, but just a function. Okay, so the boundary is so this guy you can rescale. In fact, you know, when you draw the Penrose diagram for flat space, again, if you don't do it the sort of very cheesy way that I did it last time by sort of thinking of it as coordinate transformation of just compactifying the coordinates and then by sleight of hand saying, okay, now I can talk about the boundary. The really proper way is to precisely do it as a sort of subset of the really conformally compactify and have it as a subset of a cylinder of the Einstein static universe. And there you find that, in fact, indeed this I-naught, the spatial infinity is just a point rather than what you might have naively thought. You know, you might have naively thought that the flat space Penrose diagram in two dimensions look like this, and you might have thought that if you have more spatial dimensions, you just sort of rotate this diagram to get higher dimensional flat space time Penrose diagram. That's not true, and in particular it's very misleading because you would have thought that the spatial infinity would be very large, would be a two-sphere because, you know, going that way infinitely far and going that way infinitely far should be very different. That's not the case. They, in fact, are a point like this. Okay, so that's just an aside.
So you can draw here the entanglement bridge, right? This is the...
So we didn't get into that at all. So what is entanglement wedge? So in three dimensions, you can take one of these space-like geodesics that's anchored, so it has both endpoints on the boundary. And you can consider, therefore, the region, the interval that's spanned by these, that's bounded by these two points. This is a special case of an extremal surface. If you had higher dimensional ADS and you wanted to consider a surface that ends on a given region on the boundary, now higher dimensional region, then the analog of the geodesic would be an extremal surface, and its cross-section could look very much like this. Okay, so the entanglement wedge is a construct where you take the set of points in ADS, so now let's draw our, so let's say this was our, at constant t, our geodesic that spanned this interval. The entanglement wedge for this guy is the set of all points in ADS, which is, sort of space-like separated from the surface in the direction of the boundary region we're interested in. So every point, so this is a codimension two surface. Okay, in three-dimensional space-time, this would be one-dimensional curve, so geodesic. But for any codimension two surface, there is sort of set of null perpendicular geodesics from that surface that separates space-time into sort of the future. I forget whether I didn't quite get to this notation, but I got to the past notation. Okay. The future of this point, the past of this point, and the sort of space-like separated regions. And there are two of those, just as there's two of the time-like separated regions. And your the entanglement wedge is, if you take the surface like this, it's the one that goes on one side. So it's sort of a region like this. The purple line in three dimensions is a space-like geodesic. For entanglement wedge, the purple line in higher dimensions should be the higher dimensional analog of this. A surface, let's say in four dimensions, the region on the boundary would be two spatial dimensional. And the surface you're interested in is also two dimensional. It's actually easiest to draw it on in this Poincaré coordinate picture. So let's forget about it. By Poincaré coordinates, I mean these flat slicings. So here, I suppress time, and I pick some spatial region on the boundary. There's an associated surface, a two-dimensional surface in this case, of zero extrinsic curvature, an extremal surface. But you can also think of it as an extremum of the sort of the area. How do I draw this? Maybe like this is best way to draw it. Okay. Okay, it's just a bow like this. If you take the proper area of a given surface is calculated similarly as a proper length. What you need to do, so the area, let's call this, I don't know, script S or something, area of script S, if you have a metric, induced metric on the surface, let's say gamma mu nu, and you're specifying it by some coordinates, x, well, that's really confusing. Okay, let's call y mu or something, or let me put the indices gamma ij, and these are various yj's. The area of this is supposed to be locally just looking at what's the proper size, what's the determinant of the induced metric. So you put in the determinant of the induced metric gamma in all these coordinates, dy1, dy2, up to however many dimensions the surface has. Okay, and the induced metric, so you can think of this as taking the full metric mu nu and then changing coordinates in, dx mu, dy I, dx mu, dy j. Okay, so it's just calculating these area elements and summing them up over the surface. That's an action that then you can extremize, and there's a solution. So why do I draw it this way rather than just a, let's say a soap bubble that would be flat? The reason is that, again, the distances, the proper distances here are very large, which means also the proper areas are very large, which means that the surface wants to leave the boundary as quickly as possible. So it will also end on the boundary perpendicularly. And in fact, in the context of the area of this counting the entanglement entropy of this region on the boundary, it manifestly gives you immediately this area law of entanglement entropy, the divergence, the leading divergence coming from in the CFD of the UV modes across this entangling surface is precisely the same as the leading divergence coming from just having infinite distance near the boundary and then having to multiply that by the by that this area or the parameters I have drawn it. Right. So that's but this all I think Mukund will explain in the ADS-CFT lectures for some of the other speakers. So this is a this you'll hear again.
So that has been an alert, email alert that Star Trek is starting.
Ah, good. So you should all go. Sorry.
No. I just wanted to ask you what's the plan.
And the plan is unfinished. I didn't plan to go beyond this, so yeah, if any of you want to hear more, you can. I'm happy to stay behind a little bit more, but let's call this the end of the lectures.